The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, my name is jQuery. Mike Thompson is the other voice that you hear on this program, and Landon Coons helps us put it all together. And I'm telling you what, it is a melancholic evening here on Beyond the Bricks for a couple of reasons. Number one, because of the sadness, I guess, and the fact that we have had so much fun putting together these shows and doing them for all of you over the course of the month. And it means just the world to me, and I mean that sincerely, in the fact that when I was a kid, you know, I knew about the Speedway primarily because of listening to Donald Davidson and knowing what Donald Davidson meant to notably my grandparents. My grandmother in particular absolutely loved the talk of Gasoline Alley. And just to be able to someday even meet Donald and then ultimately do a radio show that in no way, shape, or form is rival to or even close to or in the same stratosphere as Talk of Gasoline Alley, but to allow a lot of the listener base to get their fix of hearing of things about this facility that means so much to all of us and the people and the moments that have made it so great. To be able to do that each and every year, I will personally offer the greatest of thanks to all of you for your interest in it and allowing us to do it and necessitating for us to be able to do it. It goes without saying that none of that would be possible without Mike. And even though we are going to celebrate the fact that it's Carb Day and the greatest night and the greatest weekend of the year in Indianapolis, Indiana, Mike, it does give us a little bit of a pause because this is the final show for the season and they are so much fun to do.
Yeah, the last go round is definitely melancholy. I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. So, yep, but we have a fun show put together for the final one. We have to go out on a high note for sure.
Now, let's begin by talking about this, okay? We have all kinds of fun things to get into tonight, right? And one of them is about the Wing and Wheel logo. Now, Mike, I'm going to ask you a question, and maybe this is like a question that people have asked forever. I don't know. But I've always wondered this. Now, do you happen to have in front of you, Mike, I would imagine you have one somewhere, that you have a Wing and Wheel logo that you can look at right before your very eyes or pull one up fairly quickly, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, people that are listening that don't have one before them are maybe, I'm going to ask them to picture it, if you will, in their mind. But I've always wondered this. When you look at the Wing and Wheel logo, are you looking at a right tire going away from you, a rear tire, I should say? Are you looking at a rear tire as it's going away from you turning left? Or are you looking at the front right tire as it's moving towards you turning left?
I think it's the front right tire moving toward me. That's okay. How I feel about it personally. Okay.
That's probably right. Although I guess technically, you know, you're chasing somebody if the tire that you're looking at and it's in front of you, and that's the point of a race itself. But I would tend to agree with you. Either way, it's Carb Day, meaning that we're supposed to be thinking about weird, crazy stuff, right? Donald Davidson on the Wing and Wheel logo.
It predates USAC by about, 50 years.
Okay.
Yeah, it goes back to the very beginning. And
that's great.
Yeah, I The Speedway does not have a balloon program from June 5th, 1909, but I know a gentleman that has a copy. So, I mean, I've seen a private copy, and the logo, not too dissimilar from what it is now, is on the balloon program. So that goes back to the very beginning.
Oh, wow.
And but there have been a couple of claims that it had already appeared somewhere else, which has never been, just like the Chevrolet logo apparently came from a design in a hotel room in Paris, supposedly.
Right.
But anyway, the wing and wheel, as I say, there's been a couple of claims that that Carl Fisher or whoever it was had seen it somewhere else, but that's never been. I mean, I'd like to know more about that, but they did have it in 09. And okay. It was because they wanted it to be. It was going to have an aviation presence as well as automobiles, which it did for a short time.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
You know, Mike, one of the things that I, over the course of the off season, somebody sent me a photo, and they said, "Hey, can you determine what year this is? We're cleaning out my uncle's, you know, possessions." I think it was uncle. And Mike, I'll rely on your expertise here. The year that the original pagoda was torn down, I believe was 19, is it 56 after the race?
Yeah, the new Master Control Tower debuted in 1957.
Okay, so someone has a photo that they sent to me. It's a black and white photo that has no pagoda in it, and they couldn't figure out what year it was. And, of course, it was from 1956 because there was a brief period after the race in 56 where the pagoda was taken down and then a master control tower was built. When I was asking Donald for more information to clarify about that, that was the first time, and I guess I should have known this, that I realized or was informed that the new pagoda we see today, the bones of it still on the inside, are in fact the master control tower. So it wasn't necessarily a complete tear down and rebuild, but nonetheless, you know, it's the skeleton is there, if you will. But there have been a lot of things that have taken place in terms of the demolition of the original pagoda and changes that were made. Donald Davidson with a great pagoda story. This is from the Talk of Gasoline Alley in 2004.
Then the building now that's called the Pagoda, work began on that. Actually, it was approximately 2 years to get that completed, because in 1999, the radio broadcast booth actually was in an elevator shaft, and we had to go up and down in this noisy bucket. But I think that about covers it, except that the second Pagoda, the 1926 one, was for several years. I mean, it was becoming a real problem, becoming very dilapidated, and it was rickety, and it would sway with the breeze. It would sway when people would climb up the stairs. The fire marshal kept restricting the number of people that could go up there, and it got tighter and tighter and tighter. And then finally, even in 1952, they said this is the last year for the pagoda. It was still there in 56, and then on this magic day, apparently, they decide, okay, we're going to do it. And on mid-morning, June the 30th, the story is that Clarence Cagle gets a telephone call. It's Tony Holman, and he says, "Gee, Clarence, you know, I've really been thinking over about the pagoda." He says, "Boss, I hope it didn't change your mind. It came down this morning at 7 o'clock.
So. Now, you hear some crazy stuff. Carb Day's crazy. Carb Day's so much fun. I love everything about it. Mike, a couple of years ago, and I think you'll appreciate this story. A couple of years ago, I was at a Pacer game. You've probably heard me tell this story. And I noticed an accent on the gentleman behind me. Turned around, it was in December, and he was from Australia. Brought his son to the United States to see the Pacers play because they had become Pacer fans, and they came all the way to Indianapolis to see the Pacers play. So I asked him, "Hey, do you have a tour guide in town while you're here?" They did not, so I took it upon myself to tour them around town, which of course meant going to the Speedway, taking them around, taking them to the Bricks, and everything that goes into it and everything that goes behind all of that. And as we were forming this friendship, which is very strong to this day, he said to me that he wanted to come back for the Indianapolis 500. He came back. He brought 8 friends from Australia, which included his brother-in-law. And on carb day, they came to carb day, they soaked it all in, and then you get the opportunity to go down on the track. And this was a couple years ago, so it was a gorgeous day outside. And Arthur, his brother-in-law, was weeping. He literally, when we got down to the bricks, was weeping. And he said, you just don't know what it's like to be from the other side of the world and to be able to come here on this day and on carb day to see what this means to the people from here in Indianapolis and the people that this race means so much for. And for me, I never thought I would be here. I just never thought I would be here. And here I am. And that's what I love about Carb Day, Mike. It's why this show tonight, the Carb Day Potpourri Celebration Show, is so much fun, because it, to me, Carb Day is the ultimate day for everybody to be able to just kick back, celebrate, and have fun. And why shouldn't we do it on the radio show as well?
I agree with that. I think it's a good celebration for everybody. Absolutely.
Now, there are those that, when it came to the race itself, you wonder if maybe their celebration would be tempered by, or even, for that matter, completely impeded by getting mugged before the race. Dick Rathman in 1957 had some severe misadventures that were talked about on Talk of Gasoline Alley in 2019.
And then in 1957, he was part of the Chapman Root and Don Smith team that ran Sumar Specials. And they had three cars. And Dick Rathman qualified along with Pat O'Connor and then also Marshall Teague, who was actually went to school in Daytona Beach and was the first of the NASCAR drivers, if you like, that came and ran Indianapolis after they were an established star. Pat O'Connor won the pole. And Dick Rathman qualified a virtual twin sister to that, Curtis. And then Marshall Teague in the older car qualified. Well, Dick Rathman ran into a situation, and I'll have to tread around this rather carefully. He showed up with a black eye. In fact, more than that, a swollen eye. And it was swollen badly enough that he couldn't put a helmet on. And so the medics or somebody decided, look, son, sorry, you can't run. And so he was parked. There was a version that a kid had thrown a rock to hit him in the eye. There was another version that he got beaten up by a hoodlum. The second one is probably closer to the story, which apparently he was down on Indiana Avenue. For those of you that were living here in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, he was down on Indiana Avenue and paying attention to a young lady. And she had a suitor who rather objected to the attention. And so apparently he got punched. And so... And not in a position to be able to drive. And so Johnny Parsons Sr., who had actually qualified for JC Agajanian but been bumped, was then invited to drive the car on race day. But
now, Mike, I kid you not, just a week ago on my afternoon radio show, shameless plug, Query and Company, that takes place from noon until 3 on The Fan in Indianapolis, I don't even know how it came up, but I discussed Wonder Bread. J&V and I were talking about like just an old loaf of white Wonder Bread and the design that comes on the packaging of it. And it turns out we already know that there's a connection between like hot air balloon racing and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But Wonder Bread also is tied in with IMS, right, Mike?
That's correct. Wonder Bread is very tied in with Indianapolis, which I didn't know until a couple of days ago that Wonder Bread was designed, I guess, in Indianapolis. It's an Indianapolis brand originally, and apparently Wonder Bread got its name from an event that happened at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Donald Davidson on that.
There is a connection, but I think there's a misunderstanding, and I can't remember what the claim of the company is now, but the supposedly that the founder of the company, whose name escapes me now, supposedly he said that the balloons going up on race morning was a wondrous sight. And so the name came from there. The And what do you have in mind is the fact that it's the balloon race, during the singing of Back Home Again in Indiana. Well, the problem with that is I don't remember when Wonder Bread was founded, but I know they had race cars sponsored in 1933. And the balloons didn't go up on race morning until 1947 or maybe 48. It's one of those 2 years. And that was the suggestion. And I was guilty of this myth that I was saying that it was Mary Frederick Holman, because what I had been told it was Mrs. Holman's idea. Well, it turns out it was Tony Holman's mother that had suggested that, Grace Smith Holman. But anyway, either 47 to 48. So I think that probably if in fact the gentleman had seen balloons go up at the Indianapolis Speedway, then it had to be the gas-filled balloon race.
Elmer Klein?
Is that it?
Name ring a bell?
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, which is rock solid.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad you're using that for the source.
Taggart Baking Company is what it was originally called, yeah. From Indianapolis. Debuted in 1921.
Okay.
And after a blind promotion with ads that only stated a wonder was coming on May 21st, 1921, when it was launched, the new brand was named by Vice President for Merchandising Development Elmer Klein, who was inspired by the international balloon race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, according to Wikipedia.
Okay, the balloon race. Well, that's closer then, because the version for a while, it gave the impression, I haven't read it for ages, it gave the impression that it was seeing the balloons go up on the morning of the race, of the morning of the 500-mile race. But he may have attended the 1909 event, or they did have other balloon races there. But anyway, I'll just wind up with I'm almost sure it was Wonder Bread. When I was brand new in town, I was in 1964. I actually was guested on a TV show on Channel 13. It was the Don Melvoin show, and I don't know if anybody remembers that, but Don Melvoin was a comedian, and I believe that Jeff Melvoin that did the Northern Exposure was either his son or maybe being related, because it was certainly spelled the same. Anyway, the Don Melvoin show, and they would have guests, and they had a little group there. There was about a five six piece outfit, and they used to do live commercials. And I'm almost sure it was Wonder Bread that had the 500 loaf. And he was talking about this 500 loaf, and one of its features was, it had 33 slices of bread. I wonder if anybody remembers that.
Mike says potpourri. I say cornucopia. It means the same thing. It means that we have all kinds of great clips that we're having fun with tonight for Carb Day, including one of the all-time classics. The all-time classics. You know what it sounds like, right? But you got to listen to it closely, because as soon as you realize that it's here, there it goes. We'll get into that next.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons putting it all together. This Carb Night Potpourri edition of Beyond the Bricks here on 93.5, 107.5 The Fan. WIBC as well also airs this program from time to time, or in podcast form. And we have done in the past request nights. And Charlie Smith sent in a special request, and we had to accommodate because it's one of our favorite clips from the first year that we did the show. Now, this is Norman Boardman from KWIK Radio in Burbank, California, calling the 100-mile Gold Cup race at Gilmore Stadium, a URA race held on May 6th of 1948. There were a lot of future Indy 500 stars like Roger Ward, Bill Vukovich, Walt Faulkner, Bobby Ball, all in this race. But it became legendary on the show for Norman's, Mike describes it as, occasional lack of descriptions. Here it comes.
Now Rod Sims is about six car lengths out in front of Taylor. And then about three car lengths or four car lengths behind Taylor, it's Billy Vukovich. And there goes Bill Zering, and there goes car number 38, Eli Vukovich. There goes Bob Barker, there goes Bill Burden, and there goes car number 29, that's Bob Ball. And here they come down through the north turn again. It's the leader, Rod Sims. He's increased that lead on Taylor. He's about 10 car lengths in front of Taylor. And then Taylor's about 6 or 8 car lengths in front of Vukovich. 91 laps have gone by. Only 9 laps to go. Here comes the leader, catching up with Bobby Barker. He's lapping Barker. And then about half the straightaway back, it's a second place car, 98 Bill Taylor. Car number 45 is out. Car number 45, Billy Vukovich, is out. Car number 7 running third. Here they come again, going down the back stretch is the leader. Here comes the leader. 96 laps for Rod Sims. And there's Bill Taylor. There goes 29, 6. There goes Rod. There goes the third place car, car number 7, Bill Burden. There goes car 29, Zering. Car number 21, that's Al Sherman. Here they come again. It's the blue flag this time for Rod Sims in car number 10. Blue flag for 98, blue flag for car number 13. Blue flag for 29. And here comes your winner in car number 10, Rod Sims. In second place, Bill Taylor.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, for the era, that probably was pretty remarkable, but let's be real here. I don't know that Norman, he sounded a little bit like Chris Farley interviewing McCartney.
You remember when Rod Sims was winning the Gold Cup race? That was awesome.
That was something right there.
Remember that one time when Bill Taylor was out there? That was great.
Man, that is good stuff. No question about it. By the way, speaking of Roger Ward, even Indianapolis 500 stars occasionally had difficulty getting into the track on race day. And Ward had a unique solution for that problem. Donald Davidson shared this story with Mike Sarawak on the all-night race party in 2007. And pay attention, too, because I think the James Tavern decided that they wanted to accompany this with their own instrumental music. Maybe they were delivering strawberries. I'm not sure.
He had at one time lived very close to the track. But after he won the race in 59, he bought a house more than a short distance away. I mean, on a clear day or with no traffic, it wouldn't take very long. It was up on Kessler Boulevard. In fact, he lived. I always thought this was how appropriate for a hero like Roger Ward. He lived at the corner of Galahad and Lancelot. I'm not making that up. A house sat on the corner right next to the Broadmoor Country Club. So anyway, he had had difficulty getting to the track in 60 and 61. And so he said to a crew member, a young guy named Al Friedman, who went by the nickname of Einstein, who was probably about 19 at the time, and he said, "Hey, kid, I got a job for you. Find a route for me to get in here on race day without any trouble." So Einstein happened to notice that there was a helicopter taking off and landing in the infield on the golf course, not off any distance away, but was coming in and landing right in the infield. So he said, "Well," he said, "what would it take to hire you? Would you be available for hire on race morning?" And so, yes, and I don't know what the financial transaction was, but anyway, to the, a number of people have told me this, including Roger Ward's sons, plus neighbors that lived up at that area that I just mentioned. At the appointed time on race morning, 9 o'clock or whatever it was, this helicopter lands on the golf course at Bromore Country Club, and out comes Roger, and I think the two sons rode with him, I think, and off the chopper takes, and all the kids are pointing up in the sky, and chopper gets to the track in like 5 minutes, and I think, I don't know, I think they charged, the pilot charged him $5 or something like that. And so that was big time for those days.
I feel like there was some sort of a 60 or like an ABC television drama taking place in the background that was about to start.
Look, at some point, I guess you have to bring out the royalty-free music CDs at some point, and, you know, they have to be utilized, and I guess that's where they decided to use them.
That was, the music itself, literally, I felt like all of a sudden it was going to say, you know, except on the West Coast, your late local news follows. 2006, by the way, at the all-night race party, Paul Page shared memories of a very embarrassing moment as the chief announcer of the Indianapolis 500 Radio Network. It's so embarrassing, as a matter of fact, that he probably wouldn't have even told it if his wife, Sally Larvick, hadn't been there to push him along.
I listened to Paul doing the rundown of the race, and I didn't realize it came from this race, but this is a story he always tells when he's speaking about the race and things that happen.
Oh.
Yeah, so, no. Yeah, and I didn't realize it came from the 84 race until I was listening back to it, and you got to tell the story. And you'll hear it.
That was the in those days, because we were the only live origination race, it was very important that we give the lineup. But not just, it had to be done slowly. It had to include the driver's name, his hometown, legal sponsor on the car, and his qualifying position. And it had to be done so that everybody could write it down, because the coverage just simply wasn't what it is today. And a lot of, you know, the Austin, Texas paper may not even have had the lineup for the 85. So all these people had to get that information some way. And so we had to give them the starting lineup very carefully. And I taught this. And I had the starting lineup always pasted on the back wall. So here I am, and I'm reading. And I'm doing it, you know. Like, on the pole, Tom Sneva, the Texaco Star. That's the pace you're on. So I'm getting bored, and I'm looking at, and the guys in the control room where I have this pasted are making faces at me and everything. So I get down the list, and I introduce, because now I'm totally daydreaming while I'm doing this, Danny Ongais, the Intercourse Racing, and then realize what I'm saying. And that snapped me back to focus pretty quick.
So you said,
and
I
when it was
up.
Over, and Rick won it, when I got back to the garage to hang with Rick, he said, "My brother called. All he could tell me about was you and Danny Ongais' car at the opening."
The center of the fourth row, car number 25, Danny Ongais, the Interscope Racing March. The outside of the fourth row, the only four-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, A.J. Foyt Jr. of Houston, Texas, in car number 14, the Gilmore Foyt Racing March.
Paul certainly sounds like he was a little more dialed into attention to detail there by the time he got to A.J. Foyt, right, with that wake-up call.
Yeah, I think he was definitely snapped back to reality a little bit after that.
Listen, the gaffes happen from time to time, and believe you me, we have recordings of all of us making mistakes or, you know, catching something that can be used as an innuendo, and then you look back and you get a little bit embarrassed about it. Our friend Keith Johnson, Dr. Indy, sent us this one from the 1993 race involving a driver that we discussed earlier this month, talking about Stan Fox and a good-natured correction that happened on the air.
Indeed, Nigel Mansell doing a great job. He comes by here and completes another lap, 72 laps now in the books, as Bob Forbes is with Didier Tays.
Well, the foreign driver's been doing very well, but it's been a rough day for the gentleman from Belgium, Didier Tays. What happened out there, Didier?
I'm Stan Fox, so I'm the guy from Wisconsin.
I'm sorry,
heck,
Stan.
Foreign guys, us American guys are having fun. I just had a little engine problem. The car was real well balanced, but we started blowing some oil out, one of the pop-offs or something, so had to pull her in.
I'm going to have to get better glasses to check 91 from 92.
Now. I'm a lot better looking than that Didier guy.
Okay, Stan, thank you.
You bet.
Stan Fox out of the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
You can learn right there if there was ever any question about it, Mike. That's why Stan Fox was one of the more popular guys amongst his competitors at the time that he was racing.
Absolutely. As I mentioned a few nights ago when we talked about it, he was a great guy. I mean, absolutely fun-loving, quick with a joke, quick-witted, you know, had a lot of fun. I mean, just an absolute joy to be around.
And, you know, he's a lot better looking than that Didier Tays guy, too.
That's right. And he's neither foreign or out. You know, he's. I love that. I'm the guy from Wisconsin.
I'm the American guy from Wisconsin. That's right. Good beer both places, Belgium and Wisconsin, though. I can tell you that much. Not that I would know. All right, we come back. It's Carb Day Potpourri Night. We'll put a tie on all of it next.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Hane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, for the final segment of the season, if you will, and getting set for the running on Sunday, the 109th Indianapolis 500-mile race on this Carb Day Potpourri edition of Beyond the Bricks. And oh, so much fun we have had over the last month or so sharing with you all of the different stories, the commercials, the hijinks, the fun, the laughs for the Indianapolis 500-mile race and those personalities that make it the greatest race in the world at the greatest venue, of course, in the world, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It is so big, by the way, is the Indianapolis 500 that it has always been customary that the winner gets the kiss from a number of different dignitaries, certainly the 500 Festival Queen. And before that, movie stars of the era would be brought to Indianapolis just to kiss the winning driver on behalf of the BorgWarner company. That doesn't mean, though, that every single driver went ahead and turned around and made that obligation come to fruition. Donald Davidson from the Talk of Gasoline Alley 18 years ago talking about Maury Rose and his not kissing the winner.
Oh, well, Maury Rose is who you're referring to. But
who's that?
Well, okay, but there's a story.
What is the story?
There's a story. He didn't. What happened was that there was actually two ingredient there, and 1948 was the year, and Maury Rose had won the race the year before, and Borg Warner would bring in Hollywood actresses to greet the winner in Victory Lane, and in 1948 it was an actress named Barbara Britton. And she was married, I think, to a doctor of some kind. Anyway, he was sort of along as sort of the reluctant husband. And she was the first year it was Carol Landis, and she was between marriages at the time, I think. And she was she was a really sporting and had fun with everybody. Barbara Britton was more of a lady and married to this fellow who was a gentleman. So on the day before the race, there was a bunch of people in the garage area, and Maury Rose happened to be close by, so he overheard the husband say something about the fact that he really didn't have much interest in racing, and he was a little uncomfortable about tomorrow because a grimy race driver was going to be pawing at the at his wife, and so Maury Rose just made sure that the fellow got eye contact with him, and so when he pulled into Victory Lane, and then there's the other angle is that Maury Rose, his first wife, had passed away, and he was engaged to another lady. He had two young children who had both been affected with polio, and he had helped them through their recuperation by building exercise equipment for them. But anyway, the point is that he was engaged to a lady that he was going to marry, I think, just like a couple of months later. And so with both of those in as situations, he pulls into Victory Lane. Barbara Britton comes up, and she's sort of prepared to peck him on the cheek or receive a peck on the cheek. And Maury says, "Oh, I'd rather shake your hand." And he shook the hand and then turned around and raised one eyebrow at the husband. So anyway, that's the story on that one.
Now, Mike, I'm trying to think of who it is. I know there's an actress from that era that if you had won the Indy 500, you would not have declined the kiss, right?
Oh, there's a couple of actresses from that era I would not have declined the kiss. Barbara Stanwyck would have been number one. Erin O'Brien would have been one for sure. So, yeah, 100%.
So you differ from Maury Rose. By the way, my favorite trivia note about Maury Rose that I'm going to throw in here, since we have a minute to play with, I will tell you. And Donald is the one that had told me this story. That Howdy Wilcox, do you know this story, Mike, about Howdy Wilcox II and Maury Rose?
Yes, I do.
So Howdy Wilcox II showed up to run in the Indianapolis 500 and was informed on, I believe, race morning, if not very shortly before the race, that due to a failed vision test, he was going to be prohibited from running in the race. And he told them, no, my vision is fine, but I'm diabetic, and it just happened to be bad the day that I was taking the test. And so they said, well, if you're diabetic, then you can't run the race in general. And he said, well, I already have. I've run it before. The other drivers, due to the popularity of Howdy Wilcox II, no relation to, but same name as Howdy Wilcox, the previous winner, or the prior winner, I should say. Howdy Wilcox II basically came to an agreement that he would be able to pick who it was that replaced him. And so he picked a young rookie who had yet to go through the rookie orientation, and it was Maury Rose. And Maury Rose ran in the race, of course, went on to become a multiple winner. But Maury Rose, in terms of those days, as I understand it, Mike, was the only driver to be able to run the Indy 500 without going through the formal rookie process in doing so. All's well that ends well, but an interesting anecdote as to how he ended up in a race car.
Well, that was a bit of a big mess because the other drivers basically said, we're going to go on strike and not run the race because you're not allowing Howdy Wilcox II to run the race, and we think that's unfair. And Eddie Rickenbacker said, we're going to have a race, whether if it's just me out there, one car. And when they all finally saw that Rickenbacker wasn't going to back down, that's when they sort of acquiesced, and then the compromise was reached that allowed Maury Rose to run in the race. But you're right, that was a big situation.
By the way, speaking of those drivers that we know less about that are a little bit more mysterious, if you will, of the last 50 years or so in the Indianapolis 500. In 2016, Donald Davidson was doing Talk of Gasoline Alley and was asked who is the most mysterious driver of the last 50 years. He said Michigan's Tom Klausler.
Yes, now there's an interesting character. Tom Klausler is probably, he gets my vote for probably the, not obscure necessarily, but the driver about whom the least is known from about anybody for the last 40 years or so or Absolutely. More. And he drove in 1981 and was an early out. It was the, golly, I haven't thought about this for a while. It was a turbocharged Chevy. And I think it was a turbocharged V8 Chevy, which made it different from the others. And I'm getting myself in deep water here, because at that time there was some V6 turbo Chevy. So I'll say that I think it was an experimental engine that Champion did a lot of work with. And was it called the ADS Idea? I think. Boy, I can't believe I pulled that one out, because I haven't thought of that in ages. And I think it was an unusual chassis. Was it a ski? Something like that. Anyway, but he was an early out. But that was his only start. And he was a sports car driver. I think he won a couple of Can-Am races, or at least one. And then shortly after driving in the 500, just pretty much disappeared. Well, he lives in Michigan, and he works, I think, in Dearborn or somewhere. And I know people that try to get his autograph, and I think he doesn't respond, or it either very rarely or not at all. Okay, Mike Thompson is saying not at all. And I've heard that co-workers, when they find out he drove in the 500, and they tried to talk to him about it, and he won't discuss it. So I don't know what that's about. So just a very private and very mysterious driver. And as I say, if you get the list out of everybody that's run for the last 40, 50 years, that's the one where people say, well, gee, I don't remember him. So that's about all I could tell. I think he may have run Mini Indy a little bit, which was Super V's, but there was at least the one Can-Am win in probably 79 or 80.
Now, since talking about Tom Klausler, it turns out he has resurfaced, Mike, and actually now is not as mysterious as he once was.
Well, I don't know. He may still be mysterious, but he has actually started signing autographs a little bit through the mail again. So he used to sign years and years ago, and then he stopped signing completely, and then now he's starting to sign again. So a bit mysterious, but he's reached out and starting to do fan requests again.
He, by the way, in that lone Indy 500, I can't recall if he started 29th and finished 30th, or started 30th and finished 29th, but it's one or the other, and fell just a little bit short of halfway through that particular race. Mike, it's hard to believe, but the greatest weekend is upon us, and Sunday will be the 109th running, weather permitting, of course, of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And just a couple minutes left here. Been a huge thrill and honor again to do the show with you. And, you know, you just never know what might take place here coming up on Sunday, that's something that two guys might be talking about 75 years from now. You know what I mean? And that, to me, is what makes it so special.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's always the chance to see something historic. And I mean, it'll be interesting to see what we're talking about later on from this race. And like you said, I mean, you know, we go back and talk about things that happened from 1985 or 1981, and hopefully, you know, decades from now, somebody's going to be talking about something that happened in, you know, 2025. And that's one of the magical things about the Speedway, is it provides, you know, thrills every year, and there's always something to talk about each year, and something that tied us over to the next year. So it's always something really interesting, I think.
What is your favorite moment, aside from Taps, which is, I think, everyone's favorite moment? And that sounds unique, but I mean, because of what it means. But, you know, obviously Taps is emotional. But what's your favorite moment of the race?
You know what's interesting to me? One of my favorite things is the first time I hear Mark say, stay tuned to the greatest spectacle in racing. On the, no matter who the chief announcer is, it just, it takes me back to my childhood hearing Paul Page do that. You know, I mean, it makes me think of being a kid listening to the race with my family. That's one of my choke up moments always, is when I hear Mark say, you know, stay tuned to the greatest spectacle in racing, because it takes me back to laying on one of those old chaise lounges in the backyard of my grandma's house with my family, and wishing I could be back on, you know, 8 years old again doing that, just because those were the greatest days of my life, you know, watching and listening to the race on the radio with my family, my uncles and my dad and everybody, and then watching the race on tape delay later that evening. Is, it was just, that was my favorite day of the year. It just, and it still is, but for different reasons.
Well, we certainly hope that everybody enjoys it. We thank you for listening to Beyond the Bricks, and without further ado,